You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the latest episode, episode 37 of the City of Man podcast. This is Edward Song, and I am coming to you live from the sunny shores of Santa Barbara. Well, not so sunny today, as we're in the midst of our annual summer June gloom. But anyways, coming to you from Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, where I teach in the philosophy department here. And as always, I am accompanied by my regular co-host, Dr. Coyle Neal, the city collector of Bolivar, Missouri, and the sometimes professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University. How are you today, Professor Neal?
I'm doing well, and it's actually Collector Neal. They just remodeled the building that my office is in on campus at SBU, and I'm trying to talk them into putting, you know, College of Business, Department of History and Political Science, and Bolivar City Collector on the new sign when they get it set up.
But does that mean that, like, little old ladies come and knock on your door and, like, empty out a can of coins?
They really should, but no. Bolivar actually doesn't have a city property tax. So the Office of City Collector is left over. The state requires us to have a city collector, but we have no property tax to collect. So it's a non-job.
I literally get
elected and then I get the title and I have to do nothing. It's like the ideal job for me. The wife says I'm very good at doing nothing. So I'm like, hey, I should run for that office.
But you literally have no responsibilities.
And in fact, I don't even have to go to the Board of Aldermen meeting. So, yeah, I assume that I'm like the designated survivor. Like if something terrible goes down at the Board of Aldermen meeting and the mayor and Board of Aldermen are wiped out, uh-huh, then I take over the city.
Uh-huh.
I hope that doesn't happen.
So it goes like mayor, city administrator, all the aldermen, the dog catcher, the chief of police, the fire chief, and then you? Is that how it works?
Yeah, well, the Board of Aldermen at the top of that instead of the mayor, but yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I'm going to ask you a question now. I don't know what day we are in the Trump administration, but do you have any overall encompassing thoughts of how President Trump is?
It's not as big of a train wreck as I thought it would be.
Really?
That's not the same thing as saying it's not a train wreck. So I was listening to a debate. I forget who all the speakers were, but David Frum was one of the speakers. So he's the Atlantic editor, former Bush speechwriter, conservative sort of through and through. His analysis I thought is probably the best of them I've heard so far. And his point is that Trump's administration, in terms of cabinet level officials, and sort of cabinet heads on down, is fine. It's maybe not as good as we would have wished it would have been, and Ben Carson shouldn't be there. But other than that, it's mostly normal. There are, you know, more billionaires in the cabinet than usual. Usually there's just one, and there's like six now. But other than that, it's probably better than we could have hoped for. His Supreme Court nomination, much to everyone's surprise, was phenomenal. But the White House staff, and I think this is Frum's exact phrase, is the Star Wars Cantina Band. The problems that we're seeing are Trump himself and then the people immediately surrounding Trump, not so much from sort of the mainline bureaucracy. What do you think? What's your read on the first 150 days?
So I think that's a thoughtful analysis. I think with some exceptions, by and large, the heads of the various departments are fine. I don't know how much actual power they have in the real world anyway.
Well, it's not like Trump is micromanaging them. Like, I mean, they're more powerful than any department heads under...
I don't know if that's true. I was going to say, I don't know how much real power they have in real life anyways. And then I was going to suggest that under Trump, they probably have even less. I mean, what's Rex Tillerson doing these days?
You know, he's, from what I've heard, he is learning how to do the job pretty well.
Like, I mean, he wasn't there. He wasn't there touching the orb. I mean, if you're not in on the orb, right. Then that was the strangest thing I think I've seen in 20 years.
But if you were Secretary of State, would you have been there? I mean,
man, if you're not touching the orb of power, you are on the outside. You are. Did you see the picture in which somebody photoshopped Saruman into the picture? And they were like, the thing about this is that it doesn't look weird at all.
I saw the sword dance was my best. I only
saw a short clip of the sword dance.
Yeah. So my feel is that the bureaucracy is continuing to do its job, mostly because Trump just lacks the know-how to involve himself in its day-to-day operations. Even with something like the firing of Comey, you know, we have this guy who's a genuine American hero, gets canned, and is immediately replaced by someone who is just as competent by him. Not at the head of the FBI. I don't remember if they have a person there or not, but the special investigator, I mean, if you had to pick someone to carry on the investigation, that's the guy
sure
you would have picked. So the bureaucracy seems to be fine. It's the White House staff that's, yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted your analysis of it.
No. I mean, all I wanted to do was talk about the orb. No, I think that's pretty sound and sort of speaks to the durability of our system of government.
Which is the thing.
So that's great.
Which is the very thing that would infuriate the Trump voter, right? I mean, to lead into what we're talking about today, like that, the idea of the durability of the system is exactly what they voted against.
I guess so.
It's the system that has to be broken and replaced.
Mm-hmm. I think... In terms of my overall take on things, after the election, as I was grasping at straws, my hope was something like, Trump is not ideological. Trump is also basically an actor who was saying anything to get elected. My hope was that he would find responsible adults to run the government. He would rise to the occasion. And then what we see is that... I think he's borderline crazy. I think he definitely has some kind of narcissistic personality disorder that is disabling. I don't necessarily mean that it's disabling to the extent to which he should be impeached. But it's scary to me. And so, you know, everything that you said I think is basically right. But you wonder the extent to which it is impossible for him to do something extraordinarily rash, you know? And so in some ways, my hope, I don't think he's likely to be impeached. And I don't think that it's not likely that he's going to be impeached, certainly before the midterm elections and maybe even after that. And so in some ways, like, I actually kind of hope that he isn't impeached because I sort of worry a little bit more about the legislation that would be passed by Pence, who I think is ideological in ways that are worrisome to me anyway.
Oh yeah. And I would, if Trump is impeached or if the move process is brought into play.
Yeah.
Both of which of course have been making the rounds on the internet. I think the next step beyond that is Pence would have to immediately resign just because you don't want it to look like some kind of coup, right? You don't want it to be like, this is a legitimate president being removed by a cabal of ministers. And that would...
Yeah, I think you maybe had posted an article on Facebook
The National Review article.
It was the Krautheimer. Uh-huh. It was a Krautheimer article. But the thing that I worry about is that he's going to do something genuinely rash, and there's going to be nuclear war in North Korea or... You know? And it's easy for me to be a little bit less exercised about this because, like, I'm not an immigrant who just got kicked out of the country. So anyways, happy, happy, fun. Let's talk about populism, Coyle.
Yeah, let's talk about populism.
So our topic for the show today was occasioned by two articles that you, Coyle, found dealing with the topic of populism. But it was kind of interesting. One was an article in The Atlantic written by Matt Stoller, who actually... is a budget analyst on the Senate Budget Committee. He was sort of talking about how populism formed an important part of Democratic DNA through the better part of the 20th century, but then it lost it it sort of lost its soul. He is arguing for the importance of the Democratic Party to sort of re-embrace that kind of populism, which you can certainly see in the politics of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But then you also found this other article entitled The Crisis of the Conservative Intellectual, and I think that was written by Matthew Continetti in the Washington Free Beacon, is that right? Talking about the rise of populism in the latter half of the 20th century within the Republican Party and within the conservative movement, who's very much ambivalent about the influence that has played on contemporary conservatism. So it's sort of both articles sort of brought up these dueling perspectives of the role of populism in their opposing parties. And it's kind of funny in some ways because the Atlantic article was sort of like, wow, Democrats really need to embrace populism. And this other article by Continetti was very much like, populism has been really bad for conservatism. But why don't you kick us off and say something a little bit in general about populism in
yeah, so in so populism politics. is basically the exactly what it sounds like, right? It's the idea that the people should be the primary political force in the nation, particularly a majority of the people, or at least a large minority of the people. They should have the political power. Primary legitimacy, primary sovereignty rests with them. As opposed to the few, right? It's always sort of the many versus the few. Who the few are will depend on what kind of populist you are, whether you're on the right or on the left. But this is certainly longstanding in Western history. So back in ancient Greece, you have the Democrats versus the oligarchs in basically every polis in the Greek world. There's some combination of conflict there. In the Roman Republic, you had the optimates and the populares, right? The elites versus the populists. In the Middle Ages, you have these sort of occasional populist movements that kick off, sometimes religious in nature, sometimes not. My favorite of them is a revival. Political revival that was led by a guy named Cola di Rinzo, who was a buddy of Petrarch's, who decided he was going to restore the Roman Republic by appealing directly to the Roman people, going around Pope and around the civil leadership of Rome. He managed to get himself elected tribune and was eventually on the sanction of the Pope, sort of torn apart by a Roman mob. The populism turned on him, but again, just this idea that it's appealing to the people against the nobles. In the United States, this kicks off in the early part of the 19th century. Either coming from Christianity or coming at the same time as a populist movement in Christianity, as the American Revolutionary generation dies off. The idea starts to grow that it's not enough just to separate ourselves politically from England. We shouldn't just be replacing English aristocracy with American aristocracy, however informal it may be. We need to be a completely different political culture. That means rather than deferring to informal aristocratic elites like Washington and Madison and Jefferson and Adams and so on, we need to be listening directly to the American people. The first guy who really taps into this and makes good political hay out of it is Andrew Jackson. Probably not a coincidence that Donald Trump moved Andrew Jackson's portrait in the White House into the Oval Office, which is, I think, telling on a number of levels. But Andrew Jackson sort of famously...
Yeah, and Andrew Jackson was going to... He could have ended the Civil War before it started, right?
He was a great negotiator, though. Right? Unlike that pansy Lincoln...
Totally.
So
sad. Weak.
Right.
He let himself get shot. I mean, what kind of leader is that?
A friend of mine did a Twitter series on Trump tweets history that was pretty fantastic, and I think that was one of them. Jesus was born in a manger. What a loser. I was 18 pounds when I was born and could already read and write or something like that.
The Trump National Bethlehem is a spectacular property. Very classy.
Right. Oh, man. Oh, right. So Jackson, let me get derailed there, which is probably appropriate. Populism sort of gets derailed in America a little bit during the Civil War, because, of course, everything gets derailed during the Civil War. And in some ways moves back into American religion. So as all of this is going on politically, just as a side note, the same thing is happening religiously. You have a wave of kind of democratic idealism sweep through American Christianity. Prior to the early part of the 20th century, if you wanted to become an influential Christian preacher, you would have to go to one of the Ivy League schools. You would have to be from the right kind of family. People start saying, well, why should we have to listen to these intellectual eggheads? Every man can read his Bible for himself and come up with just as good an interpretation as the big elites that are coming out of Harvard and Yale, particularly when, you know, Harvard and Yale at this point have both sort of gone Unitarian or functionally Unitarian. So they don't believe anything anyway. No creed but the Bible becomes the big rallying point. The book to read on that is Nathan Hatch's Democratization of American Christianity. It's basically a short version, well, not that short, but an explanation of what happens religiously that also happens politically. After the Civil War, populism picks up again, especially in the American West. It never has quite the same punch that it has in the Jacksonian era, in part because populists are divided in ways that last into the 20th century and that we're going to talk about with these two articles. But the idea is still a popular one. The idea that we ought to be appealing to the people as opposed to following the leadership of the elites. Again, who the elites are becomes kind of the big dividing point. And maybe that's a good point to go into the article. Ed, do you want to kick off with the Atlantic article? Who are the elites from the perspective of the left?
Yeah, so Scholar tells this interesting story about obviously all of the changes going on in American society in the 60s and 70s as they manifested themselves in the post-Watergate era that really led to the shift of the heart of the Democratic Party. So the article sort of kicks off talking about a new wave of post-Watergate liberals in the 70s, right? So just after Nixon had been deposed, this new wave of post-Watergate liberal politicians swept into Congress in the wake of that. And Stroller calls them the Watergate babies. And their politics were very much informed by Watergate and by the Vietnam War. And they swept into power very much as young idealistic liberals with this real concern for cleaning up government, ending the war in Vietnam, ridding the capital of all of the corruption and dirty politics.
So still populist, right, in its rhetoric?
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, very much populist in that regard, and very anti-establishment in some ways, because they realized that when they got to power, what really mattered was chairing committees, and committees were a matter of seniority. And so part of what they did is that they upset the system, and they sort of took it upon themselves to target the old guard Democratic leadership. And the chief target in this was a congressman from Texas called Wright Patman, who had served in Congress since 1922. He was the chair of the House Committee on Banking and Currency, and had been a really influential and an important figure in Congress over those years. And Patman was from Texarkana. He was a former cotton tenant farmer and a fervent populist in his party. Solar sort of tells a story about how progressive politics through the better part of the 20th century was fervently populist, oriented towards trust busting and breaking up corporate monopolies, and really focused on trying to break up concentrated economic and political power. And while these new congressmen were themselves populists in their own right, they were interestingly anti-war, but not necessarily anti-bank. They didn't have the same kind of preoccupation and worry with concentrated financial power, and were in many ways very comfortable with large corporations and free market finance and all of that. And he writes how this generation, even though democratic, had themselves sort of been informed by like the revolution in neoliberal economics that started at the University of Chicago Milton Friedman was famously influential. He was a University of Chicago Nobel laureate and enthusiastic. But Solis sort of talks about how that kind of neoliberal economic thought was itself influential on certain parts of the Democratic Party through different kinds of channels. And these Watergate babies were not necessarily anti-bank. They were comfortable with large corporate power. They were free market and pro-finance. And they were more than happy to get rid of that old populist guard, people like Patman. And so they swept into power. Their concerns were primarily about cleaning up government, about social reform in the wake of the civil rights movements of the 60s. Again, very post-Watergate. And they ended up putting together a new kind of coalition of social progressives. You know, they put together a kind of a coalition of African-American civil rights interests, as well as the interests of highly educated Eastern elites and business interests. And so, you know, who came to power in this 1970s window? Well, important people like Paul Tsongas, Al Gore, Michael Dukakis, Bill Clinton, Gary Hart, Bill Bradley, Richard Gephardt. You know, these people sort of swept into Democratic politics in the 70s and ended up reorienting the heart of Democratic politics at the expense of this kind of populism that Solis argues really was at the heart of the Democratic Party through the better part of the 20th century. And again, really at the heart of this populism was this conviction that political and economic freedom are deeply intertwined, and that real democracy requires not just the opportunity to vote and participate in politics, but an opportunity to compete in an open marketplace, right? So there was this real focus on antitrust and breaking up large corporations to make sure that not just political power devolved down to the people, but economic power as well, right? So there was concern about
this is older populism, right? Not the Watergate.
Yes, older populism that was concerned about these large corporations sweeping in. So Walmart would be like the classic example of the kind of big corporate force that an earlier generation of Democratic populists would have been vociferously against, precisely because it was this consolidation of economic power that led to, you know, all of these small mom and pop businesses going out of business. So Stoll is really arguing for, and he sort of traces out how this trend continued through the Clinton administration, which really championed the kind of deregulation that led to the great financial crises in the earlier part of the aughts, and then equally in the Obama administration, and really arguing for Stoller is very supportive of figures like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders as part of this revival of Democratic interests in economic and political populism.
Yeah, no, it's really I think he's. Maybe the title of this is a little misleading, just because it's not as modern Democrats are not populist. There's a shift in populism, right? From that older, like I said, the older style that is anti the elites in that case are the banks, right? The elites in that case are the businesses that would swamp out the small ones, to sort of post 1970s Democratic Party. They're still populist, but instead, like you point out, there's this coalition. Stoller says African Americans, feminists, affluent young college-educated whites. If the Republicans have the Southern strategy, the Democrats have the urban strategy, where they're. So it is still a kind of populism, but it's a populism that's aimed at breaking up the cultural elites, the sort of dominant American tradition, and to some extent maybe the dominant American legal system, in favor of something that's more popular, something that's more inclusive and aims at everyone. So I'm surprised he didn't mention, although I guess he was focusing primarily on economics, but something like Clinton's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. I mean, that would be a great example of a a small but direct shot at kind of what was the was once upon a time the reigning cultural hegemony in the country, in an area that's clearly within the president's purview and something that he could do without having to consult Congress or anything like that. Just, you know, changing one line on the application to be a to be in the military. Again, that's the, it's not anti-populist, which if all you read this article is the headline, you come away thinking, oh, you know, those awful elitists, you know, elitist Clintons, that's not exactly what's going on. It's just there's a different focus.
Yeah, well, it's this embrace of social and cultural concerns and inclusivity and making sure that people aren't marginalized, but those social and cultural concerns aren't. And yeah, you know, social and cultural concerns that are of interest to working class African Americans, but not necessarily to working class, white working class people living in the Rust Belt or through the South. Yeah, you know, so you started off with this very nice definition of populism to start things off. One of the interesting things to me is that, like, really, in both articles, it isn't really about populism in the sense that you define, but it's really sort of about, like, the white working class voter.
Well, yeah, and I'm not completely sold on this this Atlantic article. And maybe this is just being a conservative. I don't think of the stretch between, you know, 1970 and now as this era when there's just no economic regulation going on. Even in terms of trust busting, and I am not an economic historian in by any stretch of the imagination, but I at least remember the Microsoft antitrust lawsuits. So there's still something going on out there that involves, you know, going after the larger corporations. So it may be that the motivation for the economic regulation that's happening, you know, so something like EPA, I doubt they care about, you know, the size of businesses. Their concern is environmental, but it's still regulation. It's still economic regulation. I'm not completely sold on it, but he'd make an interesting argument that I hadn't quite thought of before. I don't know. What'd you think of it?
No, so that's right. I mean, but the interesting thing to me is, so it's certainly there are things that are against type going through that. But I mean, he notes that, like, a lot of the deregulation that we associate with Reagan were actually begun by Carter in the latter part of the 70s. And that talks in really interesting ways about the way in which, like, neoliberal, libertarian-style economic theory gets brought into the Democratic Party through some very influential, you know, liberal economic thinkers. And, you know, certainly there are things that tell against that story. But obviously, when you look at the direction, I mean, the most significant economic event of the last 30 years was the financial crisis. And, you know, that was kicked off when Glass-Steagall was taken off the books at the very end of the Clinton administration. You know, and so that was a legislative act. Republicans and the Clintons were very, very interested in getting rid of. You know, that was on Clinton's watch. And certainly in Clinton, and it really picks up in Clinton that you really see, I mean, you know, so Rubin, what's Rubin's first name? From, was his first Treasury Secretary. Larry Summers was also a Secretary Treasury. I mean, progressive in their politics, but people who are certainly friendly to large financial corporate interests. And, you know, really, especially with the Clintons, you see sort of this tipping into in this embrace. And even, you know, in the Obama administration, he put in place certain kinds of regulations that were taken apart at the end of the Clinton administration, but it didn't go nearly as far as some people like Elizabeth Warren. And there's a lot of concern amongst progressives that, like, Obama, for all of the things that they love about Obama, that Obama is still sort of a little bit too friendly to Wall Street interests.
Yeah, and again, it's I understand why the Bernie Sanders crowd, for example, would think that. It's hard to see that from a conservative perspective, but I would imagine even from a more liberal perspective, when you think Democrat, you don't think economic libertarian. You think higher minimum wages. You think, you know, more benefits. You think, we could go just down the list of things that were at least present during the Clinton Clinton administration, if not actually enforced. So yeah, and again, it may be that the motivation for all of these things was not anti-business. It was something else, whatever that something else, progressive politics of some kind. So maybe it is just the foundational philosophy that has changed, even if the practical results look very similar.
Well, yeah, I mean, Solar makes a nice point that, like, there are a couple things that certainly tell against the narrative, but in general, the trend has been towards deregulation. Now, deregulation coupled with an interest in higher taxes, and more recently, for example, a concern about raising the minimum wage. But Stoller makes this nice point about, and I can't remember exactly how he puts it in the article, but like what they share with Republicans and current Democrats share kind of a common picture of how the economy should work. And it's this picture in which you allow large corporate interests to coalesce and to get really big and to run unfettered in their economic activity. And where they differ is just sort of in how the benefits of that economic productivity shake out, right? In terms of higher taxes or lower taxes, or higher minimum wage or lower minimum wage. But Solar think that's more or less just dickering over a shared kind of a model that embraces in a fundamental kind of a way deregulation.
Yeah, and again, that's...
Yeah, and so the environment is a little bit of a special kind of a case. I mean, you know, but the economy these days is so much driven by corporate finance. I mean, it's technology and corporate finance. And with regard to both of those areas, it's more or less laissez-faire.
Yeah, but even then, and again, this is this might be another problem of motivation. I just, in terms of regulation of big business, something like net neutrality, right? I mean, that was not a Republican or a conservative proposal, right? That was something that came from the progressive side of things, and it's. It's an attempt to regulate, not directly, but regulate what people are doing on the internet rather than just having sort of the libertarian view of letting the market do what it will. I know that's a terrible summary of it, but it's directly targeting monopolies. By definition, it's directly targeting monopolies. So I think he's maybe overstating his case, even if there's something to the basis of it. And it might come back to what you said, the white working class. Like, it's who are the people that you're being a populist for?
I have some questions and worries about the Solar. I mean, I have to say I'm a little bit ambivalent because in some kinds of ways, maybe I'm a little bit more pro-market than your average Bernie Sanders progressive. But there's some other worries about the article that I want to get to. But maybe it would be better actually to sort of talk about the Continetti article about conservatism and populism. So why don't you kick that off?
Oh, sure. So basically this is a sort of history of conservatism in one sense that explains where populism fits into what conservatives have been doing for the last century. So Continetti argues that there are basically four big stages of conservatism in the 20th century, starting with what he calls the old right, the opponents of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, people who disliked the growth of federal government, who disliked the First World War and the Second World War and the growth of financial power that of necessity went along with that, and that sort of that opposition to the federal government de facto meant they were supporting the robber barons, right, the big businesses of the day. Because as the Solar article points out, one of the things that the federal government was doing was trying to regulate these massive industries. Then a second wave comes along with William F. Buckley and the founding of National Review, where you have kind of a bringing together of this old right and classical liberals, and then anti-communists all sort of come together in this one guy. He actually opens the article with a debate that took place on Buckley's TV show between Buckley and Ronald Reagan over this treaty in Panama that today, of course, nobody knows anything about, and I don't think it even matters because Panama, the Panama Canal is now Chinese property, so I don't know that it's functionally relevant anymore. It was just a divide that sort of highlighted a fracture within conservatism.
Yeah, that was a little bit surprising to me that that was such a big deal. I certainly don't remember that or even understand why that was such a big deal amongst conservatives in the right at the 80s.
And I had not heard of it before I read this article. So, I mean, it must not have been that, I mean, that big of a deal in historical perspective. But at the time, yeah, it was a big thing. And then at the end of the 1960s, beginning of the 1970s, you have the third movement conservatism where liberals get disgusted with what's going on in new liberalism with the war protests and some of the new left movements on colleges, some of the violent turns that the new left takes, where they sort of jump ship and come over to the right. This is where the neoconservatives come into play. But then he says what all of these three groups, this sort of old right, the Buckley conservatives, and then these neoconservatives, they all blend together fairly well, and they're all in some ways united with each other to some extent in being elites, kind of the word of it, maybe aristocratic is the better way to say it. But then you have this fourth movement in conservatism, where you have conservatives who begin directly appealing to the American people, particularly in the wake of the failure of the Great Society and the failure of LBJ's social engineering and the mass chaos that introduces into American culture. You know, the rioting in the streets and the race riots in the major cities, and all of the results of these leftist policies. You begin to see people appealing. You begin to see politicians, particularly in the Republican Party, appealing to the American people as a whole. So he says that's where you have this crisis of the conservative intellectual come in, is you're part of a tradition that is inherently aristocratic, but that at the same time now has a 50-year history of appealing to American people. And how do you navigate those waters? How do you balance between the two? Particularly when this populist streak in conservatism is so anti-establishment, whereas conservatives, you know, by definition have to be sort of pro-establishment because we're conservative, you know, we're all about preserving and saving something that usually means what currently exists, the powers and the offices and the institutions and so on that are in place. And kind of the culmination of this is Donald Trump. Right, Donald Trump is the guy who sweeps in as a Republican and says, I'm going to smash up the establishment in the name of the American people. And this I think highlights the difference between leftist populism of the Bernie Sanders stripe, sort of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren stripe, where you have the elites that are dangerous are the big businesses, the banks, the economic elites. You have on the right this idea that it's the political elites that are the real trouble. So we're going to smash up their power, to strip them of what they've got, by putting this guy in place who will do exactly that. Anything out of the article?
No, that's a great summary. Yeah, there's this nice line in there in which Buckley is quoted as saying that. That like that generation of conservative thinking, there's a way in which, I mean, so they were highly educated, they were wealthy Northeastern elites, right? And but there was a kind of an otherworldliness and even kind of tragedy to their political outlook, right? So there was the sense that the West was in decline and there was nothing to be done. And there's this nice quote from Buckley in which he sort of admits that the National Review in the 70s had been guilty of the theological sin of otherworldliness, the belief that as long as one's own life was free of sin, one needn't worry about the affairs of the world. And so populist conservatives sort of burst in and were like, we're going to break stuff.
Or again, in the more positive, we're going to restore the real America. Right, we're going to put real Americans in charge, turn control back over to the people, and take it away from these liberal elites. Continetti makes the very true point that every election that the Republicans have won since the 1980s has been on the back of populism. So Reagan, Gingrich, George W. Bush, the Republicans in, 2010, 2012, in Congress, and now Trump. I mean, those are all direct appeals to populism.
Yeah, so that's right. And so the article is sort of talking about how conservatives in some ways made a deal with the devil, and they sort of rode this populism into political power, but at the cost of really sort of compromising like genuine conservative, anything meaningful about what it is to be conservative, right? And then I always get Nadir. Is Nadir High Point or Low Point?
I don't remember.
Well, in any case, it doesn't matter because it depends on. But like the Nadir of this is Trump, who isn't a conservative, who in his bones is a pro-life Democrat, but who just doesn't have any political views whatsoever, right? And so like the manifestation of all of this, and you know, and you can kind of see the track through like through. Well, so Reagan really embraces this strategy. Reagan kind of accidentally begets Bush, the former, but he doesn't last very long, precisely because he's the same kind of like establishment political figure that the populist right has no interest in. And then you get the second Bush, who really is bringing in something of more genuine kind of, you know, so he was folksy and anti-intellectual and a man's man. And then we have Romney tries and fails because he also is an elite establishment type. And then so finally we run through the gauntlet of all of these figures in the Republican primary, all of the presumed favorites. Well, Bush for one. Establishment. Jeb Bush never gets anywhere aside from the fact that he had the establishment support. And then I'm trying to remember. Were you a Cruz man or a Rubio man in the beginning?
I was originally a Scott Walker man, and then he dropped out fairly early. Uh-huh. So Rubio was sort of the horse I rode. But it's probably important to point out the irony that. All of presidents and most of the presidential candidates since Reagan have all run on populist platforms, with the possible exception of Obama. None of them are truly men of the people, right? They're all firmly entrenched establishment individuals. Reagan, governor of California, Hollywood actor, George H.W. Bush, certainly establishment, New Englander, no less. Clinton, Oxford Rhodes Scholar. Governor of Arkansas, George W. Bush, son of a former president, Barack Obama, Ivy League educated, college professor, even Donald Trump, for all his I'm a man of the people, is a millionaire. So Ivy League educated, and so on. So there's always something, I think, disingenuous about the we will vote for this guy because he's on our side, understanding that he is... In who he is in his person is not one of the people. It's not like he was grown up, raising hogs in the middle of Iowa. I don't know how I got on that, but that's somehow I want to point that out.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you remember this, but during the 2000 campaign, Gore was trying to run a real populist strategy. And I remember thinking how weird that was. I mean, part of it was he was running away from Clinton for obvious reasons, but he sort of went with this weird pop, and I remember thinking that was so, I was like, so weird. It's like, what is he doing? Maybe it's just the fact that his political strategists were smarter than everybody else, and they could see the writing on the they could see the writing on the wall, but it was like a surfer who caught the wave too early. And then,
well, they both ran as populists, right? George W. Bush ran as the outsider, right? He's the guy who really,
yeah,
the yeah. Again, the millionaire son of a former president, Ivy League graduate, governor of Texas, ran as the outsider of politics.
Yeah, skull and bones.
And I mean, it's in some sense that makes sense, right? You can't really be an outsider and run directly for president. If nothing else, Ben Carson proves that. You're not going to get anywhere. You don't know the right people. You don't have connections. You don't have the party support, and so on. But yeah, there's still something disingenuous about the claims being made to represent the people when you're part of the people that you're targeting. But all that might be a tangent. Sorry, I mean, trail us there.
I was a little bit surprised when you recommended the article. It's really kind of super interesting. And I do have my sort of the big take on both articles is that neither of them talk about racism. And I mean, what really happened in the 70s was and we should be really clear about this, like the Republican Party of the 50s and 60s was the party of Lincoln. And looking at the civil rights legislation of the 60s, maybe this isn't exactly right, but it's more or less the case that just as many Republicans have voted for all of that, the civil rights legislation, as Democrats.
Well, more as a percentage, just because there are fewer Republicans in Congress.
Yes. But in any case, like, the Democratic Party was the home of all of those segregationist Dixiecrats. But in the 60s, they made a decision that they were going to embrace civil rights and go all in on that. And they were going to build a coalition of urban African-American voters and Eastern elites. And that was the way that they were going to go. And, I don't even know that that was necessarily, I'm sure a lot of that was real moral conviction and high-mindedness. I'm sure a lot of that was also just political expediency. But in any case, that's the direction that they chose. And then all of those ex-segregationists, they left the Democratic Party and they all joined the Republican Party. And both articles sort of downplay the role of race in those political transformations. I don't think Solar really talks about it at all. And then there's this really telling line in the Continetti article. Continetti quotes Kirkpatrick Sale, who wrote a book in 1975 called Power Shift. And so this is the quote. In talking about all these political transformations, Sale writes this: racism is a part of it, though somewhat muted in recent days. Again, Sale writing in 1975. But more potent still is a broad adversarianism, a being against. Wallace has no real policies, plans, or platforms, and no one expects them of him. It is sufficient that he is again, and gathers unto him others who are again, again the blacks, the intellectuals, the bureaucrats, the students, the journalists, the liberals, the outsiders, the communists, above all, again, the Yankee establishment. And so Continetti is approvingly quoting Sale on this point. And I mean, I think that's right. A big part of this populist mindset is just this adversarianism. But that line about racism is a part of it, though somewhat muted in recent days, that is severely underplaying like the role of race that's going on. And it was muted. It's, you know, and relative to this, to the, well, certainly the 50s and 60s, yeah, the racism was muted in the 70s. But like, it's a mistake to think that it wasn't. It was publicly muted, but privately, like a very real force that was driving a lot of those political changes. And I remember, I think we talked about this. I can't remember what I was reading, but this was back during the election, and somebody was sort of talking about like the rise of this populist political movement that swept Trump into power. And the author was sort of making the point that like before the civil rights era, it's like a very raced phenomenon. We're not talking about working class voters. We're talking about white, really Southern and Appalachian Rust Belt white working class voters. And this article is making the point that before the civil rights era, that population was sort of evenly divided, and some were Republicans and a lot were Democrats. And because they were sort of divided, their political power was diluted. But then after the civil rights era, in which all of those voters left the Democratic Party and entered the Republican Party, now their power is really concentrated in such a way that they could actually exert influence. And it sort of unleashed this force in American politics through the Republican Party that was growing and developing through the 70s and 80s and 90s. Gingrich plays a really important role in the reshaping of the Republican Party. And then it comes to a head with the financial crisis in 07 that sort of unleashes this torrent, and the Tea Party movement and All of Us Gives, again, it sort of reaches its nadir, whether that means high point or low point, just depends on how you want to think about it, in Trump. So I was really shocked.
It's nadir so far.
There's always tomorrow.
Yeah. We got more elections to go.
And it's crazy to me, you know, so there was the knife attack in Portland. I mean, you know, a lot of this is just with social media, there's just so much more publication of news. But like these insane things going on with the knife attack in Portland, or back in Charlottesville, Virginia, home of my alma mater, the University of Virginia, you know, Richard Spencer shows up to do a with torches and his crew of like alt-right white supremacists to protest the removal of a statue in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is just about the bluest little dot that you'll find anywhere in any, well, certainly anywhere in the South and anywhere in the country. Just like these crazy things.
Well,
going
I suppose
on.
The more generous interpretation of that change, and we should also get back to the Democrat side of it. The more generous interpretation of the shift is that Republicans start focusing on concerns of the white working class, while Democrats shift away from those and start focusing on concerns of urban working class, particularly African-American poor. I think the article you were talking about was that Vox authoritarianism article that wanted to
argue
that's
the one.
You know, all Republicans are secretly racist or something along those lines. I don't deny that there are certainly Republicans who are racist, but I would deny some of the premises there. I am not a historian of the 1960s and 70s, but I think it is possible to say at least that Republicans shift their narrative so that instead of, like both articles sort of point out, instead of being the bastion of New England business, right, Northeastern big businesses, they start being much more the voice of rural and poor communities, which tends to mean white working class. That where people mm-hmm. who are racist are in that particular way are more likely to go, but it's certainly not the exclusive home of racism. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of, you know, Black Panthers voting for Republicans. We see similar demographic shifts on the Democrat side of things. Right, we see again this shift in populism to where it had been the concern of the poor white working class, to a focus almost exclusively on the cities. And I think that's the thing that's largely missing from these articles is the mm-hmm. rural urban mm-hmm. split. The discussion of this transformation that goes on between the two parties, that's almost a complete switch. Right? I mean, the Republicans largely mm-hmm. have been the urban party, mm-hmm. And now it's the Democrats. I don't know how much else I wanted to get into there. Anything else on this populism stuff?
So just like one point on that. I mean, it's true that stylistically, Democrats' concerns turned to urban environments, but it's not as if Democrats' preferred public policy proposals also didn't benefit those rural white working class people as well, right? It's not as if food stamps and unemployment benefits and health care and job retraining and all of that stuff, Medicaid, it's not like that only helps inner city African American, like that helps the poor rural white working class too. And it's
but from the perspective of the poor rural white working class, whether they're right or wrong, if that's not what they see as the help they need.
Yeah, so I was going to make this point, and then, to me, the divide has nothing to do with economic or public policy issues. It has everything to do with, like, moral outlooks and values. And, among the moral issues that we could talk about would be things like, abortion for one, I guess, and especially just like the general kinds of social transformations in America. I mean, so gay rights and all of those things But even beyond that, like, it really gets to this, I mean, this issue that we talked about in the Hillbilly Elegy episode about, like, the honor culture mindset of the American, of the American South that proliferates through this white working class voter that we're talking about. It's not a economic or policy hostility to, it's this moral hostility to, like, again, the cultural change issues, the place of women in society, especially, you know, gay and lesbian and transgender persons, abortion too. But more than that, it's the honor, I think it's like the honor culture that really prizes, well, it's agrarian in its outlook. It really prizes individualism, pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps. There are no hurdles that a person can't overcome. It's wrong to complain about things. It's wrong to pay any attention to injustices done to you. You just need to put your head down and work harder. And this really high premium on slights to one's personal dignity and honor. It's like more that moral framework that I think the Republican Party has embraced. So, and so to a certain extent, on the policy level, like the vision of the conservative ideal of small government, individualism, work hard, free market, that fits in with that. And just in a way in which the progressive policy vision doesn't.
Right, and you turn that around, and you have the same moral difference on the on the populist left, right, where the enemy is not the government with all of these evil progressive policies. It's the banks. It's the businesses. Mm-hmm. It's again this elite obstacle that is being set in the way of people to keep them from achieving prosperity and happiness, and so on. So yeah, you're right.
That sounds a little bit more like a policy story to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, your narrative sounds more like a policy story to me. Like, it's the difference, I think, is you're right that there is a moral view, but it's who do you see the bad guy as? Is it the so far it has been, at least in the last, you know, 30, 40 years on the right, it's been the liberal political establishment. Whether the establishment is actually liberal or not, it's that's certainly the rhetoric. On the left, it's been, again, the banks, the businesses, the cultural elites, I guess, if we're going with Stoller's analysis. But if we're going with sort of straight Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren narrative, as and assuming that they are the representatives of the populace on the left, I mean, it's sort of the banks all the way down, right? They are not just bad because of their policy; they're wicked and they need to be broken up. And that's a moral position.
Yeah, but it's not the same kind of moral framework that constitutes like the honor culture, right?
Well, I don't necessarily. So yes, there. I'm sure there's still an honor culture in this that does not include all of the white working class. Certainly doesn't include the West. It doesn't include the Rust Belt. It doesn't include the white working class in New England. I mean, that's a very specific region. And Donald Trump certainly did not speak in terms of honor culture when he was campaigning. It was all government elites, right? It was all political elites that were.
So I don't know if Donald Trump ever uttered the words honor culture, but. But everything else in his campaign rhetoric sort of fit into that, the moral universe of the honor culture, right? So like the embrace of violence, the suspicion of us against them, the suspicion about immigrants and outsiders, this kind of manliness, this toughness. I mean, all of that speaks to fits into the honor culture moral universe, even if he isn't using that language. And then, I mean, to your point about that doesn't describe, like, the way in which that manifests itself through the various different regions of the United States certainly is, it varies, especially your point about the West. I mean, the West is a different thing, but the honor culture begins in the foothills of Appalachia. And then I think sort of, and then flows out and becomes the dominant kind of moral framework of the South in general. But then it follows the hillbilly highway up into the Rust Belt, up into, well, the Appalachians extend through Virginia, and then we go sort of up into Pennsylvania, up into Rust Belt Rust Belt area. So now Ohio, again Pennsylvania, parts of New York, and so it's not just about like the foothills of Appalachia now. It's basically like the American South up into the Rust Belt, and the West definitely is a different kind of thing. But there's a way in which I think the moral framework of the West is a kind of a cousin, insofar as like the West was driven by this sort of very American individualist agrarian kind of expansion, where you could always head a little bit further west, and if you were tough and hardworking, you could find your way in the world. And so that's sort of distinct in some ways from like the classic hillbilly honor culture, but like it's a relative to it.
Well, I'm again, without getting too much into the weeds of regional differences, I think the unifying populist narrative, West, North, South, on the conservative side, particularly as articulated by Donald Trump, is we have been oppressed by the powerful few, particularly in Washington, D.C. Their oppressive legislation has eliminated your jobs. It's decimating your culture. Vote for me and I will take care of it. So basically everyone I know in the West who voted for Trump, even the ones who did so grudgingly, it was almost exclusively because of either Obama administration regulations that decimated the coal industry or Obama and Clinton-era regulations that decimated the agricultural industry. It wasn't the honor culture. It was these politicians have destroyed my livelihood, mm-hmm. and I want it mm-hmm. back, and this guy has promised it to me. So again, I think that's sort of the anti-establishment populism on the right takes the form of we don't like the government, whereas the anti-establishment populism on the left, again, meaning Sanders and Warren, at least in our current time, means we don't like economic leaders. We don't like the economic powers that be. The rhetoric ultimately, I think, is basically the same. It's we need to break them up, vote for us, and we'll get rid of them. And that, again, is going to appeal to different people, mm-hmm. different demographics and so on.
I hear your point about coal and agriculture. I think that's right. I think a big part of Trump's popularity was also just sort of the style of the rhetoric.
Oh, sure. Sure. There's no doubt about that. He's the tough guy.
Which fits into that sort of honor culture moral vision.
And yeah, I mean, again, that's probably fine for the South. I have no particular objection to that there. I don't think that would have been enough to tie his base together. What about the stuff on the left?
The part of it is just like the rise of really disturbing like neo white nationalist movements around the country. I mean, that's just really striking to me. Like, that's not accidental. This guy in Portland, the rise of Richard Spencer. What's the name of his institute? It's like the National Policy Institute or something.
Yeah, something like that.
It's the most spectacular, like Orwellian. The rise of David Duke, not that David Duke ever sort of disappeared, but like, and just the rise of hate crimes and neo-Nazi groups throughout the country, like, that's not an accident, obviously.
What's your analysis of the, like, the populism on the left? We've been focusing on the right. Left populism is as big, if not bigger, than populism on the left. Maybe without the tradition of favoring the elites that conservatives had. What do you think about the Atlantic article and the arguments we've been making all along?
Yeah, so part of this gets to a kind of ambivalence that I have about the embrace of deregulation in the Democratic Party. And there are ways in which I am vociferously a free market guy. And I really have, like, no tolerance for a real kind of socialist left. Just because a lot of the rise in standards of living and economic benefits that we all enjoy are the product of capitalism. And I mean, it's like there's a certain way in which now that we live in a global economic world, I mean, there just is no going back. And we could erect, you know, we could erect tariffs and trade barriers and things like that, but they're just not going to work, and they're not going to make things better. And, you know, when people are sitting around trying to hammer out these trade deals, whether we're talking about NAFTA or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is that what it's called? It's like economists know that if they lower trade barriers, they know that it's going to grow GDP by some percentage, right? So the reason why we did NAFTA is that we knew that passing that would grow GDP by 2 or 3% over some period that just wouldn't exist without it. We just knew that lowering those trade barriers is going to increase economic output and wealth.
Right, but both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, at least I'm assuming Trump would say this since he agrees with Sanders on some of these points, would point out that GDP growth in those cases meant the wealthy are getting richer and that the poor are losing jobs. So is that actually a fair trade?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And so there's a way in which our economy as a whole grows. To a certain extent, depending on what we're talking about, everybody enjoys lower prices, and that benefits everybody. But there certainly is this way in which the benefits of globalization, the burdens and benefits of globalization aren't being shared in a fair way. And so to me, like, my preferred way of addressing that problem, again, part of it is there's just no going back. But part of it is as well, I think, is probably a little bit of a principle case that free market under the right conditions really does benefit everybody. But then under the right conditions. And then, you know, you really need to erect a kind of a system to make sure that that 2% of GDP is going to be shared in an equitable way, right? And so to me, we need to pursue trade programs that are going to generate that economic efficiency and economic growth. But that has to go hand in hand, basically with higher taxes, to make sure that the benefits of this trade trickle down to the people who are definitely not going to benefit from it in an immediate way. Through
so people can lose their jobs, but we'll have really good welfare programs for them.
Well,
this is conservative. I would talk about the dignity of having your own job.
And yeah.
How that's, you know, a good life on welfare is worse than a struggling life with a, you know, meaningful work.
And well, look.
So I guess I should say...
It's worse than a good life with...
A life where your income is comfortable through welfare is worse than a life where your income is maybe just barely sufficient when you have a job.
Yes. Yeah. I understood that. So look, I mean, it's going to be, I mean, you're going to need welfare programs to float people through the transition, but then you got to spend a lot of money in job retraining and job development to make sure that people have a chance to succeed in the new economy. So, but part of it is like those steel jobs, they're not coming back.
You know, people say that. I don't know about steel. Coal, at least, the jobs went away last year. Like, it's, you know, the last 90 days of the Obama administration that most of the job losses happened. To say they're not coming back, I'm completely sold on that. Just because it's not like they've been gone for a decade.
Yeah, okay, so a word about the coal. I was reading this really super interesting article. Obama-era regulations, and then really the work of a lot of nonprofits that have spent a lot of time suing coal companies and trying to get them shuttered. That's certainly played a role. And with regard to coal mining in West Virginia, I remember reading this article that, I mean, certainly they haven't been helped by Obama-era regulations. And I'm going to come back and defend the regulations in a second, but anyways. But it's more that West Virginia coal is dirtier and harder to extract than Western coal.
Right, and I know Western coal. I don't know West Virginia coal as much. But I mean, if those
West Virginia jobs aren't coming back.
If a, you know, good philanthropic billionaire like, say, Michael Bloomberg were to come along and donate $15 million to the reopening of the coal mines in the American West that are just sitting there, all of the equipment's there, the trained labor force is there. It's just a matter of starting them up again. You could even do a, hey, we'll just reset 200 days ago, and that would get them going again. Again, it's not beyond the realm of possibility. The $15 million numbers, that's the amount Bloomberg has pledged to donate to the work of the Paris Accords. It's how much we had originally promised, and then Trump pulled us out. So, you know, a matching donation to American coal, would bring the industry back to where it was last year, at least.
So, okay, and so now I'll go back and I'll defend the regulations. It's not like the coal industry is a neutral industry, right? They're producing really massive third-party effects that are bad for people.
Like low power prices and...
That's bad for the planet.
Affordable electricity is terrible, Ed, let me tell you.
Well, look, come on.
Jobs, man, awful.
You know, you and I have talked about doing a global warming episode. So let me just say this. The planet's getting hotter. I don't know how much of a skeptic you are about whether global warming is man-made. We can have a conversation about, we can have an extended conversation about that. Typically, the conservative line is, yes, the Earth is getting warmer. This is what David French was writing about the other day. Yes, the Earth is getting warmer. Yes, it's because of burning fossil fuels. But we don't yet know exactly how far-reaching the effects are. Nobody really knows about whether it's going to be, how bad a thing is going to be. Maybe it's even going to be a good thing. And what we do know is that they're going to be very real short-term costs in the part of these coal workers who aren't working. And then, you know, French sort of decried this progressive alarmism about all of that. And then I would just say, the Earth is getting warmer. It's because we're burning coal. But and it's true that predicting climate change over a 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 year period, that's hard.
It's witchcraft.
Sorry?
It's witchcraft.
It's
like, it's astrology, Ed.
Okay, so we're going to go back and we're going to have a debate about that. But what we know that carbon dioxide makes the planet warmer. We know that. We know that we've been putting tons and tons and tons of that over, since industrialization, and we know that the Earth is getting warmer. And then we can start to make some predictions about whether it's going to be 2 degrees or 5 degrees. But we also know, that the ice sheets are melting. We know that the oceans are getting higher. And in fact, there are communities in Louisiana that have been deserted because of the threat of rising water. Parts of Miami regularly flood when there are heavy rains now.
Let's save this for the global warming episode.
Yeah, okay. So that's right.
We can get into how apathetic I am about global warming.
So that's crazy to me and very not conservative. But so here's the point. There are going to be costs. But it's actually an opportunity because it's an opportunity to invest in new technologies and green energy, which is every bit, and which can totally compete on price with
government
with
subsidies.
Fossil fuels, and so, like, would you rather have a coal job that is definitely good? I mean, even if we revive those factories now, I mean, if you were going to buy stock, you wouldn't buy coal stock because that's a declining industry over the next 10 or 20 years. What's not a declining industry? Green energy. So why aren't we spending all of this? So that's where the money comes in which we're going to train people so they're going to be prepared in pursuing green energy jobs.
But why are those mutually exclusive? Like, fine, coal's on the way out. If coal's on the way up, it's on the way up. Let's not falsely shut down using, you know, regulation. Let's let it die naturally and let green technology, when it finally catches up in terms of efficiency, whenever that is, then it can step in and take on the role that progressives want it to play.
Okay, so then I would just say it's now. Green energy can totally compete
when it receives no more government subsidies than coal does. That's when we'll hit
That's totally true. I mean, and part of it is it's not as if the coal and gas industries aren't subsidized. If they took away the coal and gas subsidies, they can totally compete on a level playing field. But the technology is totally there. It's just a question of capacity.
But you can see where
so there's no point
the coal
in
miner
building
to say you're...
a new coal mine. Sorry, there's no point in building a new coal factory, for example.
I'm not even saying a new one, though. The ones that are already there, they're in mothballs, have been for the last 200 days, turn them back on.
We don't need them.
If you're a coal miner, what you're hearing is, to make this political point and, you know, reduce the statistically insignificant carbon footprint that American coal contributes to global warming, we're going to eliminate your job. Now, whether he's right or not, that's what he hears. So it's, to me, not surprising that he comes along and votes for the guy who said that is crazy.
I totally get that. So I'll say that's what he sees and thinks. That's false. The contribution to global warming isn't a small fraction of a percentage. But we don't need the coal. We don't need the factory to be on. We don't need their electricity. And so if we have a choice between getting electricity from a dirty source that's harming the environment or getting it from a clean source, a cleaner source, this includes natural gas for what it's worth.
Right.
Like,
which is the reason just make prices haven't gone insane already. I mean, the reason they have not is because natural gas hasn't hit its summer high for power. When it does, all of us might be in trouble paying our power bills.
We'll see. But it's a capacity issue. It's not a technology issue, and it's not a price issue.
Let's save that for global warming.
But anyways, I mean, how do we even get to talking?
Right, so we're talking about leftist populism.
Yeah, and so I think my take is to embrace globalization, in part for because there's no going back anyway, but also in part just because I think for principled reason, and it's going to be globalization with significant regulations. So I would love to go back to full-on Glass-Steagall. Since the Depression, we didn't have a financial crisis until 7 years after we got rid of Glass-Steagall. And,
you've got inflation crisis of the 70s.
Sure,
and you've got,
but that's child's play compared to what happened in 07.
I mean, if you were trying to live in the 70s, you wouldn't say it's child's play. It was a big deal.
Yeah, that was a big deal. But that had nothing to do with a line between commercial and investment banks. I mean, that
no,
had
it,
nothing
it had
to
different
do with
costs, but it, again, it's not to say that it's not the same thing as saying there's no economic crisis after the after World War.
Sorry, yeah, but none related to Glass-Steagall and none nearly as severe as the Great Depression or what happened in 07. But so I sort of feel like we need to embrace we need to embrace globalization, but it's going to be globalization that is regulated. And globalization in which it makes sure that the benefits and burdens of our economic cooperation, which is good for everybody, but only if those benefits and burdens are distributed in a fair way.
So the question is,
right? Which is going to be
the question is, how populist are you?
Yeah. I think that we need to make sure that we have economic policies that make sure that the benefits and burdens of globalization redound to everybody. So that we float people when they lose jobs, and we make sure that healthcare isn't dependent upon having a job, and we invest in job retraining and industry development so people have access to really great 21st century jobs to live great and decent lives. I guess that's populist. But then I kind of have to say that with regard to like this sort of white working class populism that everybody is talking about these days, yeah, I don't know. Like, slavery is the original sin of our country.
Right.
And I literally think that every bad thing going on in our country basically has to do with the legacy of slavery, which we haven't really dealt with. And I think like this culture of honor is sort of implicated in all of that. So like on that specific, like the culture of the white working class itself, like I'm very ambivalent about that.
And how about the leftist side of populism?
Breaking up the banks and stuff?
Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, again.
I like Elizabeth Warren more than I like Bernie Sanders because I think she's more of a nuts and bolts policy person who's going to sort of craft policies that accomplish the goals that we really want them to accomplish. I worry a little bit about Bernie Sanders populism, which sometimes just sort of sounds a little bit like a chicken in every pot and we're going to make education free for everybody.
That's exactly what he says, right?
I would want that kind of populism really rooted in a kind of a strategic public policy plan. This is something I've been thinking a lot about, actually. I've taught a brand new course this past semester. Basically, it's sort of on public policy. And there are a lot of there are deeper understandings of the causes of unemployment and poverty and new public policy solutions. I'd like to see it all addressed a little bit more strategically. I've been talking a lot. How about you? I'm interested in what a conservative of your stripe sort of thinks about this weird marriage between conservatism and populism in the Republican
party. Yeah, so I've been thinking about this. I've been thinking through this because this is kind of an ongoing issue. It's Continetti gets this a little bit wrong in the Free Beacon Beacon article that the seduction of populism has always been a problem with conservatism. Like it's not this thing that comes along in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. It's sort of always been there. I think in our What is Conservatism episode, mm-hmm. I mentioned the writer Irving Babbitt. His book Democracy and Leadership specifically deals with that issue. Like how do you be a conservative in a nation that has functionally gone completely populist? And what does it mean to even talk about leadership where the people believe only true leadership springs from the people? In terms of the leftist style populism that Stoller talks about, if Democrats, so assuming that his thesis is right, which again I'm not sold on, but assuming that his thesis is right and that what Democrats need to do is to get back to that early 20th century sort of trust busting mentality, I would be sort of cautiously in favor of that. I would want to experiment with that. I don't want to like try it on one industry and see how it works. And the industry I would want to start with is the health insurance industry. So we do that first and see how it works. I might be willing to go along with that. But in general,
why not banking?
What's that? No, again, before we tinker with, you know, the industry that undergirds our economy, like that props the whole thing up, try something that everyone thinks is important. Mm-hmm. If it's really as effective as you know, that stripe of populace says it is, let's see if it works. I'm a little skeptical, but the idea that, anti-big money in favor of independent local communities and independent local markets, yeah, that's fine, right? I am fine with supporting the local grocery store against Walmart. I don't have an objection to that necessarily in theory.
That's the weird way in which I'm Sanders. A little bit more on Walmart's side than you are.
Hey, I shop at Walmart too. Again, I would want that. Maybe I'd want that final decision in an ideal world to be left to the local community. But hey, if you're gonna go get governments, go with the right way. In terms of the conservative populism, the anti-establishment. Political establishment stuff, there are places where I'm sympathetic in terms of kind of policy applications, the smashing up of the liberal political elites, that does resonate with me. Being an anti, you know, political elitist, I get that and I have some sympathy with that. I think, was it the Christian Humanist podcast or the Sectarian Review? Someone said, there wasn't a horse high enough for Barack Obama to sit on. I don't mind so much, you know, knocking him off of it once in a while. But, I'm still suspicious of the populist motivation behind that. As much as I may agree with some of the practical policy here and there, I think it's dangerous to appeal to the mass of people as a whole. Particularly national people, as we've seen even in this episode, we're so diverse to talk about the American people. That's a thing that doesn't really exist. We're a nation of many different peoples, and I think that's a good thing. I think that kind of diversity is a good thing, but it also means you can't appeal to us as one bloc. Doing so basically has to be the work of a demagogue, which... You know, but what have we seen in this last election, if not the election of a demagogue, the near nomination of a demagogue on the Democrat side, if not for maybe some backdoor Democratic finagling. That said, on the local level, so dealing with local politics, state politics, I'm much more sympathetic to populism. So if people of Bolivar want to vote for something or the people of Santa Barbara want to work to keep Walmart out, I have no objection to that at all. I might agree or disagree with any particular political issue. I don't disagree with the Walmart thing. I think that's fine to keep them out. But again, I think that's best left on the local level, even with all of the problems that come along with that. Right? That's how you get policies that are bad left in place. That's how you get a majority working its will against the minority in ways that are unkind or unjust. But I think the benefits of that sort of localism are far outweigh the consequences of getting rid of it. And with all of that said, I think part of being a good citizen, and here's where my conservatism, my old right conservatism, is really going to step up. Part of being a good citizen is still submitting to virtuous elites, whoever they happen to be. So finding the people out there who are competent, honest, hardworking, all of those sorts of things, and kind of throwing yourself in with them. And those are often not the people who are trying to stir up the mob against the powers that be. They're usually the people who are sort of working quietly, doing their job and keeping their mouths shut. So I don't know if that's a completely satisfactory answer, but that's what I've sort of been thinking through while we've been talking for this.
Okay. Well, that is as probably a good of an ending as we will ever likely achieve. So why don't we finish on that note? We will put links to the two articles that we've been discussing up in the show notes. So do go check them out and leave us your thoughts on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/cityofmanpodcasts. Like the page, Coyle and I often throw up interesting or thought-provoking articles, and it's a fun way in which we can interact with our listeners a little bit in the wake of some of these episodes. So please check that out. Equally, if you want to just shoot us an email, you can reach us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. As ever, we are very proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. And as always, let me remind all of you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks so much for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high